Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of intraretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, we are here with a panel we recorded well before COVID-19 was on anyone's radar. Doctors Ala Goldberg, Chris Henry, and Ashvini Reddy joined me for a discussion of uveitis and how it relates to risk management. These were part of a team that put together a panel at the American Society of Retina Specialists annual meeting last year, and as a panel accepted for this year's meeting, we still, as of my recording this today on May 13, 2020, do not have word if that meeting this year will be in person or virtual, but you'll be able to see that panel and hear more about that if you'd like to attend that panel at the meeting in July. The list of financial disclosures for all participants is in the episode description. You can also click on the link in the episode description to claim CME credits for this episode and all other episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by three retina and uveitis specialists. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Ala Goldberg, who is director of the uveitis service at the Robert Cizik Eye Clinic in Texas, Houston, Texas. Ala, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Next in alphabetical order, Dr. Christopher Henry from Retinal Consultants of Houston, where he's a retina specialist and uveitis specialist. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jay.
And last but not least, Dr. Ashvini Reddy, uveitis and retina specialist from San Antonio, Texas. Ashvini, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So we are going to do a little roundtable about some uveitis topics. This was inspired by a course actually put on by this very same group at the American Society of Retina Specialists annual meeting last year about uveitis and malpractice issues. But we're going to start first, since the first time for a couple of you in the episode, and I don't think we talked about this with you, Ashvini. We're going to go around. So I'll start first. Why did you choose ophthalmology, and why do you have an interest in uveitis?
Started with ophthalmology when I was in pre-med, and shout out somebody who was a general ophthalmologist, really liked what he did, really liked his rapport with patients. He took me to the OR and showed me cataract surgery. As an impressionable college student, I was like, this is what I want to do. So that was my interest in ophthalmology. And then at some point in residency, I decided I wanted to do retina, but we had a uveitis doc in our practice, in our residency. And I noticed that the way he approached uveitis was very different than some of the retina faculty approached uveitis, and a lot of uveitis ends up in the retina clinics. So knowing that I wanted to do retina, I decided to do a uveitis fellowship as well so that I could kind of handle the uveitis that I knew would be coming my way. That's how I ended up doing both, and now split my time between the two 50-50.
Chris, how about you?
So in terms of ophthalmology, I initially thought I would probably go into internal medicine or cardiology, something along those lines, but I found that when I was rotating from medical school, these rotations were a little bit more tedious than I expected. And in contrast, when I did my first surgical rotation, it was a real eye-opener, and I really liked the kind of immediate gratification that surgery did. And so I sort of shifted gears and started looking at some of the surgical subspecialties. And kind of as luck would have it, I was going to a party with my wife and met an attending ophthalmologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And she said, you know, you should really look at ophthalmology. So I actually took 2 weeks of vacation time during my third year, slid in a little mini ophthalmology rotation. And I kind of found that it brought everything together for me in terms of a day-to-day variety in what you do. I like the challenging surgeries, the fascinating pathology. I thought we had happy patients with good outcomes and also friendly doctors. And then finally, when I saw my first RD repair, I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. So that's sort of what set me on a path towards ophthalmology and retina in particular. And in terms of uveitis, it's more like uveitis found me, I think, in terms of, retina was really my first love, but I really appreciated the added challenge that uveitis brought. So I like the pattern recognition aspect where I can kind of look at a fundus and or an FA and have a pretty good idea of what that patient has and how to treat it. Secondly, I felt that uveitis was these patients were an underserved group. So uveitis is the third leading cause of blindness in the developed world, but I felt that many of these patients were not really given the time or the effort to take care of their difficult problems. And I felt that I could make a real difference by helping these patients. And then I think finally I had great mentors at Bascom Palmer and Tom Albini and Janet Davis who showed me what kind of a dual career in retina and uveitis could look like. So I decided to take up the extra challenge after surgical fellowship and stayed a year for uveitis fellowship. And I think it's been a good choice and I'm really happy so far.
Last but not least, Ashvini.
I was just fascinated with ophthalmology. When I was in med school, so long ago now. I think the past speaks to a lot of people listening to this podcast and kind of for itself. It's sort of the window into a lot of systemic conditions. Kind of like Chris mentioned, I was also sort of drawn to internal medicine and a lot of systemic disease. And within the world of ophthalmology, I think uveitis was sort of my calling. I think that from an intellectual standpoint, there's pretty much never a dull moment in my clinic. There's always, something that might be a little bit unpredictable. And it requires, I think, a lot of long-term thinking and conversations with patients. And it's a really gratifying thing to figure out what it is that's causing somebody's inflammation and help get them on a path so that they can see well for the rest of their lives. Chris had mentioned that uveitis is a leading cause of blindness in the developed world. That's certainly true. And I think, my great hope is that that will become less of a reality. We've got better drugs now than we did 5 years ago, even to manage these patients. And so I'm hoping, that all of us who manage uveitis, we're really hoping that a lot of the tools we have in our baskets now really will help turn things around for uveitis patients in the future.
So let's kind of shift to more the fun stuff now and kind of the basis for your guys' course, which was about uveitis and malpractice and risk. So I'll let Ashvini kind of start. We'll snake back. I think there's some obvious things that are risks for uveitis patients. We have systemic diseases. We have these systemic medications with toxicities. We need ways of tracking these patients. So if you're talking to someone out in practice who's going to be managing uveitis patients, what are sort of the biggest things to keep track of? Not only from, patient care is obviously number one, you want to have good patient care, but also from a risk standpoint.
Mm-hmm. And so good patient care and risk management basically go hand in hand, in my opinion. When you use risk management to kind of guide your patient practices, I think that everybody ends up much better. We don't want patients to be in risky situations. And in uveitis cases, a lot of times the greatest risk is when you have an aggressive or relentless condition. There's the possibility that something really, rare but aggressive might be missed. And that's sort of what the literature shows. It probably surprises very few listeners that ARN is a leading source of litigation in uveitis. It's aggressive, it's rapid, it can be bilateral, it can strike anyone at any age, and it's sort of, it can be really hard to spot in its early stages. And so that was something that we found that was really nice to be able to report. That was followed by other, sources of infectious and inflammation, syphilis, TB, toxo. Those things are not terribly surprising because they're also kind of hard to catch, kind of hard to treat. If I could give a piece of advice to anyone who's seeing a patient who has inflammation, and I think Chris and Ala would agree here, evaluate for sources of infection before you start looking at You know, even steroid drops, oral prednisone, systemic immunosuppression, because those are the patients who really, you know, if you catch them early, you can really turn around their disease and prevent a lot of morbidity.
Al, anything to add on top of that?
You know, I agree with looking for infections and systemic disease as kind of your first thought. And then the other, but the flip side of that, I think, and I don't know if this is reflected in the malpractice literature necessarily, but in practice, the patients that we see that end up losing a lot of vision from uveitis, I think, are the ones that are undertreated. So
yeah.
You have to, yes, you have to do your due diligence and be careful and rule out all the scary things, and you have to keep malignancy and your differential and syphilis and TB and other infections, but at the same time, don't waste your time continuously looking for some underlying cause when you've ruled out, you know, the things mm-hmm. that you know to rule out from the get-go, and then just start treating and treat aggressively, because what ends up happening is you end up with these patients who end up with cataract surgery and glaucoma surgery and permanent vision loss and scarring and damage and multiple procedures, and all because they weren't really treated early enough and you kind of missed the window, or weren't treated with the right medications and ended up causing more side effects than you would have if you immunosuppressed earlier. So kind of just the flip side. I 100% agree with what Ashwini is bringing up, but also the flip side of that is you have to be aggressive because it's an aggressive disease so that you don't cause vision loss.
And Chris, you can chime on top of that. And then I think the kind of the spinoff question is, let's say you rule out infectious causes, you start systemic treatment. You know, there are many retina specialists in communities or areas where there are not uveitis specialists such as yourself readily available or accessible to patients. So at what point what is kind of the stage that retina specialists should feel comfortable up to, and what point should they involve someone else, be it a uveitis specialist, rheumatologist, someone else in kind of systemic treatment?
I think it's probably just if you feel in over your head. So if you're, you know, if you think it's infectious but you can't quite pin it down, or if you're sure this patient needs to go on systemic, you know, immunomodulatory therapy, and you're not comfortable managing that it yourself, or you're not able to coordinate with a rheumatologist, I think that's a good time to think about passing it along to a uveitis specialist. Or a patient is maybe not having the expected outcome you would expect from a treatment strategy you've started, and you think they might need either an escalation of therapy or a change in gears or just a second opinion, I think that's probably a time to think about passing the patient along to a specialist.
And Ashwini, I think that there are certain scenarios that really get confusing where sometimes multiple specialists be involved. You mentioned infectious things. I think one of the more confusing things for people is the testing for TB, or what syphilis antibodies kind of mean. So, you know, testing for TB, PPD, quantiferon, you know, there's confounders sometimes. There's BCG vaccination. There's what's your pre kind of test probability. And we kind of order these tests as reflex, but I'm sure that's a common scenario that comes up. And how often do you find that you should involve, like, for example, ID before making a decision for treating for TB?
You know, I think a lot of that depends on exactly where you're located. I think Chris and I were both in Miami, and I don't know if Chris's experience a few years later than mine parallels what my experience was, but there was a lot of TB that I would see that you'd have to, you know, route to the right person and make sure was really sort of definitively treated. And so that gets really complex. Testing for tuberculosis, as you mentioned, gets really, really complex. And the pretest probability is very dependent on the person sitting across from you, where it is that they're from, what part of the country you live in, and, you know, that person's social experiences, for example, any history of incarceration and things like that kind of push the needle toward the diagnosis of DP and keep you from sort of ignoring an indeterminate PPD if one's placed. That being said, there are ways of sort of reducing the amount of confusion in the situation. For tuberculosis, I think virtually all people who manage uveitis are ordering quantiferons at this point, both for logistical and strategic reasons. When you place the PPD, the patient has to come back in 2 days. And, you know, that can be a hurdle for patients sometimes. Plus, it's really hard to place a PPD in my own clinic. If I order QuantiFERON Gold, the patient can go to a lab where I was going to send them for the rest of their testing anyway, and I can get a response back. And so I find that to be a way to minimize confusion for these patients. You couple that with a chest X-ray, and I think that you are in a good place. There are cases where QuantiFERON Gold can be false positive. That can happen. And in those cases, when I suspect that something might be false positive, which is, more rare in my practice with uveitis. Usually patients have a history that's suggestive of exposure or come from an endemic area. Those cases that are indeterminate, I might ask an infectious disease colleague to help with. In terms of syphilis testing, you have your sort of classic tests for syphilis. And I think what a lot of people are ordering these days, and what I ordered in my own clinic, is a syphilis IgG with a reflex RPR. Alan, Chris, is that what you guys are also getting?
Depends on the facility.
Yeah, I just changed. I used to do RPR and FTA, and I've changed to syphilis antibody and then RPR.
It depends on which facility I'm in. I have two facilities where, if we're in the ER setting, the RPR, it's called a syphilis screen, and it's automatically an antibody, and then reflexes to RPR. If I have to order it manually, I often still just order the RPR and the antibody, because I find that sometimes the tests get canceled, and that way I get exactly what I want with no confusion on the lab's part. But yes, the CDC has updated their guidelines, I believe, to do the screen with an antibody, and then they reflex to RPR. And most hospital labs are doing that.
The RPR is really helpful when you're following a response to treatment. So you want to see the titer obviously come down by at least fourfold, but usually significantly more than that. So that's where the RPR is very helpful.
It's helpful, right? It's not really that useful. Not that it's not useful diagnostically, but you can have a negative RPR, especially in a smoldering kind of low-grade infection or in an HIV-positive patient, you can easily have a negative RPR and a positive antibody. So the antibody is really crucial.
I think that that's all true. I had a patient whose insurance would only cover the RPR and not the FTA or the syphilis IgG. And he turned out to have syphilis, and we ended up having to pay out of pocket for a lot of those tests, too. So I think that's a consideration sometimes. Also, is what restrictions your patient might have by insurance.
No, I think another kind of the final thing to talk about risk, and we reference this, is what do you do for patients who need systemic medication, CellCept or mycophenolate, methotrexate, things that need labs to be checked, but the patient won't check their labs, or that they're just not consistent about following them. I mean, from a risk standpoint, you're prescribing medication for systemic toxicity. So I'll let Ala go. How do you handle that situation, especially out in practice?
So I have a very strict policy. When patients get started on prednisone, which, to quote Eric Zuller, is the most dangerous medication we give, when patients get started on high-dose prednisone, they do not get more than a 10 or 14-day supply because I've had many disappear. And I enforce that with my residents, who often are the first line and see the patient in the ER, and I do the same thing in my clinic. And what that serves to do is I bring the patient back within a week or two, see how they're feeling, how they're tolerating the high-dose prednisone. We talk about it. We set a taper. And then they go home with another month-long prescription or however many weeks I plan on seeing them back. Aside from that, I document that I talk to the patient. They can't stop cold turkey. They have to taper, et cetera, et cetera. The same goes for my CellCepts, methotrexates, Humiras, Actemras, Remicades, everything. I have two ways that I follow. I have an Excel spreadsheet that has an auto update with dates of when they're due for their next set of labs, depending on the guidelines for each medication. And they do not get refilled past the date when they're due for labs. So they have to keep that appointment. And I monitor those labs, and I only refill if they show up for the appointment and get their labs done.
I am exceptionally jealous of your organization. That's amazing. Chris, do you do anything similar?
So actually, the So one of the first things I did when I started here in Houston is I actually went around Houston and made friends with, like, you know, 10 different rheumatologists. And I actually went, when the clinics weren't busy, I actually went office to office and personally met them. And I sort of got a feel for who might be interested in co-managing uveitis and basically the people I liked and I felt like I could have a relationship with. And so that has helped extremely, and that I, most of my immune suppression, I'll actually co-manage with a rheumatologist that, I have a dentist and I'll be a certain part of town. I'd be like, hey, can we send this patient to this rheumatologist? And then I'll personally call them, and say, hey, this patient has burnt shot. I want to start cells to begin with. We may need to add more after that. And they'll sort of trust my recommendation. And that takes a lot off my plate in terms of their prescribing the medications for the most part. They're managing the safety labs. I just have the trusted relationship where I can advise that this is the preferred medication that I think is going to work the best. And then when you need something strong like a rituximab or something that needs an infusion, it's nice to have kind of rheumatology colleagues at hand who can do that. And so I think that has taken a little bit off my actual workload myself in following these patients. So I found that to be extremely helpful. And I think beyond that, a rheumatologist provides added value. So they may not be able to see what's going on in the eye. They rely on you to tell them that, but they may see other stuff happening in the body. You know, they'll examine the joints, the skin, they'll be doing the checking the bone density, you know, for osteoporosis, osteopenia, stuff that, you know, can become quite elaborate for us to check if we're doing it all ourselves. So I really appreciate the added value that a rheumatologist brings to the team. And that's the model I've used for the most part. Unless patients don't really have the time or resources to see a rheumatologist, I usually will work in conjunction with one.
Ashwini, I'll let you close on this topic.
Okay. Sure. I am probably somewhere in between Chris and Ala. When I was in academia, I did virtually all my own monitoring and all my own prescribing. Now that I'm in private practice, a lot of my patients have established rheumatologists, so they've got somebody in the community, you know, who may be closer to them, or, I suspect they may end up needing rituximab or maybe even cyclophosphamide for some severe cases. And so I start co-management early in some patients. It just depends very much on what the patient comes in with and, you know, how they look, and kind of my sense of where their condition might go. There are some external factors that might also influence my decision. For example, prior op is more likely to be successful for certain conditions. So if the patient can be, if the patient's RA can be validated by a rheumatologist, for example, they might be, they might qualify for a class of medications that would be difficult to justify from an ophthalmology standpoint alone. So I find that to be a real boon in the management of some patients. Some things that I do that I don't necessarily think everyone has to do this, but I do this a little bit for my peace of mind. And it also is sort of a malpractice risk issue, is I actually have my patient sign consent and informed decision-making paperwork, which is really short and brief, but kind of goes over the scary things that can happen, especially with prednisone, which Ala has quoted a mutual friend on saying that it's probably, you know, very easily the most destructive thing we can give patients. I've seen patients on prednisone for over 10 years. They come in, they're weak. They've got, you know, they've lost so much bone mass, right? That can happen. Things can happen acutely. You know, diabetics can really flare. You can put someone into psychosis. This is, prednisone is a drug that retina specialists may be prescribing, you know, very safely. But just because it has the capacity to cause a number of side effects in all sorts of ways, you know, I like to make sure that everybody understands what can happen, and that I've given them documentation when they leave my office, and that I've got documentation also. I think a lot of it is how you manage this tailored to the patients that you see in the community in which you serve.
Guys, I really appreciate you taking the time. This is a super important topic, and again, really relevant issue, especially if you're out in practice trying to manage these patients and very complicated patients. Sometimes socioeconomic factors can play a huge role in their management. So Ala Goldberg, Chris Henry, Ashwini Reddy, thank you so much for your time, and looking forward to you guys planning to run the course back this year.
We had a course that's not necessarily focused on risk management, but will probably include some interesting cases accepted for ASRS, and so we'll look forward to seeing everybody there.
Guys, have a great night. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it.
As always, you can find this episode and all other episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINApodcast.com. All 235 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You can also see a blog there that has some of our blog posts going back from our students. Remember, you can reach out to us by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website or emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We are on Facebook and Twitter, and we love to get feedback on what you think about our episodes, ideas for future episodes, and what we can do better going forward in the future. Thank you again to Drs. Goldberg, Henry, and Reddy for joining me for this podcast. Thank you to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Mike Benincasa for putting together this episode and the accompanying social media. Thank you all for what you're doing in your communities, taking care of your patients, reopening your practices, practicing safe social distancing, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.